Accession number 20935, Reel 3.
Gibson, Reel 3.
Yes, Fred used to take us out on these fighting patrols in the snow suits. It was heavy snow at the time. I know the 25 pounders had a job because they were all frozen up. And our job was to go down to the River Mars, do listening, see if we could hear anything, tanks or anything moving up. And the next job was to clear any farmhouses. On the way there, there was these tripwires and that, which would have either set a flare off or would have exploded as an anti-personnel mine on the end of each, you know. I remember we got to this big farmhouse. It was a moonlight night, and it was a sort of a sunken road with these bushes and that around, and every shadow there was a German there, sort of thing in your mind, you know. So Fred said to me, he said, "You guard this door," because it was a massive building. "You guard this door, anything comes out, shoot it." And he said to my friend, who was another Geordie from Durham, he said, "You keep your eye on the other door at the other end." And he said, "Anything comes out, shoot them." So they went in, and I was there for some considerable time. Lovely moonlight night, you know. Stood there, and I thought, that tent, they must be having a sleep in there or something, you know. Anyway, I thought, well, it's no good standing here all the time. You know, it doesn't take them all that time to go through that building. So I went round to my friend, and I said, "Have they come out yet?" He said, "No, I haven't seen a soul." So we went in the door he was guarding. There weren't a soul in there. Of course, he'd left us behind, didn't he? So he was a bit panicky, my friend. I said, "It's all right." I said, "I know the way back. I said, I know every tripwire and what have you, you know." So anyway, the two of us were making our way back through these sunken roads, snow and bushes and that sort of thing. A bit eerie, you know, when you think there's only the two of us here. But we finally got best part of the way back to the village of Wonsome. And suddenly there was these snow-suited figures in the distance. And I said to the chap, I forget his name now, I said, "That's a patrol." He said, "Yeah, it might be Germans." I says, "Well," I said, "you know, there's not much we can do now at the moment. You know, let's see what happens." So I thought I heard somebody say something from one of this group, you know, this snow-suited group. And I thought, no, they must be our lads, you know. So as we got nearer, I'm shouting, "Fred, Fred." So Fred shouts back, "Friend, lay down your arms." Of course, in the meantime, the fighting patrol have hit the ground. There's about 3 brain guns trained on us and other weapons. And I thought, this is the first time I've been in front of an English firing squad, you know. And I keep shouting, "Fred," I mean, silly really, I should have shouted, "Fred Hartle," or something like that, but now I keep shouting "Fred," and he thinks I'm saying "friend." And of course, I thought, well, I'm not dropping my rifle, and my friend was more or less my shadow at the back. He thought, well, if he gets it, I should be all right. But anyway, as we got nearer, I said, "Fred, it's us, you know. And he said, and he wiped his forehead, he said, "God, you were very lucky there," he said. I says, "Lucky?" I said, "You should have checked your squad before you left the building." I said, "You left us standing up there." And so anyway, there was nothing more said about it. The next night we done another patrol, and when we went a bit further along by the river, we noticed there was a very thick line coming across the river. And also a boat there. And I think the Dutch people must have used to use this to pull themselves across the river, you know. Anyway, Fred, as usual, he said, "I'd like 2 volunteers to come with me over the river. Moonlight night. Germans," because we used to hear the Germans singing and playing accordions and women and that over there, you know. We used to hear them playing the accordions and the right time. He has us marching about in the snow and that, you know. So he said, so nobody volunteered. I mean, it was really silly, you know, you'd probably just, because it was quite a wide section of the River Mars, and I thought that they're bound to have some guard there, you know. They'd either shoot you in the middle of the river or let you come across, you know. And anyway, this didn't happen. So anyway, he reported to the company commander, and he said, I think the best bet there is to blow the boat up. So the following night, we went down there, packed it with gun cotton, and Fred done all that because he was quite an expert at this sort of thing, and we just blew a hole in the boat so it couldn't be used. And that was it. It was, I think we were there Christmas Eve as well. I know we was on standby on the Mars on Christmas Eve, and the Germans gave us the right time. They were sending flares over to keep us on our toes. The occasional mortar bombs were coming over. Yeah, they were giving us quite a hard time. Because when you think of it, I mean, they had all the time to prepare and dig in. I mean, some of the fortifications were fantastic because the way they were marked off, it was, they knew just where to, they could hit any section, you know, they wanted to, really. But there was sometimes, if we did have a problem, like say with Tiger tanks, we used to dig in, and we'd call for the Typhoons to come in, because none of our tanks could stand up to a Tiger. And we had these markers around it that when we used to dig a hole, we had these, what do you call them, translucent, sort of a yellowy colour, stood, you know, you could see it miles away. We used to lay them outside our dugout, and they called for Typhoon support, and they used to come in, and they could blow the turret off a tank, a Typhoon. I did see one day, it never came out of a dive, it just crashed. And then, as I say, after that, we finished up in Bremen.
Can you go through the details of the attack on this barracks and how the Germans counterattacked, please?
Well, we went up by the side of these buildings. There were some buildings before the barracks, and we was told to go up there. And when we got near the barracks, we had a lot of firing coming from some of the windows up on the top part of the building, you know. Well, they brought up, I forget what it was now, I think one of the anti-tank guns had a go at it, you know, and they blasted a hole in, and I think the Germans got a bit fed up of this, and they sort of left the barracks. So we went in through one of the side entrances, you know, we was very careful to go in there, because you didn't know what was what, and we took cover in this, was a building, I think it was just on the right hand side as you go in. And after a while, we started crawling round the one side to where the firing had been coming from, you know. And we found out that there was no Germans there at all after a while. So I think it only must have just been a handful who had been left behind to cause problems. Probably these young Nazis, you know, some of them were fanatics. And I don't know whether the shell had killed anyone up there, you know, when they were shelling the top part of the building. But it was pretty quiet after that, and we thought, well, this is okay, you know. And another part of the building, there was a high window up there, and we was looking out there, looking over the other side of where the Germans would have probably pulled back. And we did spot one or two Germans there. And everything seemed a bit on the quiet side as well, you know. Something was as though nothing was going to happen anymore, as though the war had finished, you know. And of course, we just, quite casual, left a couple of chaps on guard up there and that, you know. And Fred said, right, he said, we'll have a little rest here and that. And we was just taking it easy. And about, as I say, was waiting of this other regiment to come. I think it was the Lancs, one of those that was supposed to relieve us. And we were sitting there, and all of a sudden, all hell was let loose. Of course, they had come from the side. They'd come on the flanks. Of course, our chap, he was looking over that way, you see. And they must have had two sections on each side. Anyway, they come in. They was blasting away at us. Spanders going, mortar bombs. And that's when we was just up at the side of this the main building. And we thought we were safe enough there. But anyway, Fred got his arm all... He got... You know, his arm was quite... Well, it wasn't shattered, but you two or three rounds in it, you know. Another chap got one through the side of the head. Two was killed. And me and this... he was a... I think he came from Sunderland or someplace. We were both quite shaken, you know, because... we'd never been sort of under this concentrated fire and, you know, and having so many casualties at the side of us. And anyhow, we managed to get them out of the way safely at the side of the building. And then we got to the stretcher bearers, came up and took them away. And then the other regiments arrived. And this is when the Germans started really pulling back, you know. But after a while, it was... You just think the war had finished then, because there was hardly any opposition in Bremen after that. You know, hardly any opposition at all there. And as I say, you'd think the war had ended then. But it did a short while after, which we were quite pleased about. Yeah.
What happened on VE Day?
VE Day, we were rounding up prisoners. They were coming in by the hundreds. We got them to, I forget them, it was a big, I think it was a big square there. And we marched the German soldiers up to the square, and we got them to pile their weapons. They were just marching by, throwing their weapons in piles and that, you know, there was everything going on, their helmets, the lot. And they were taken off, they were taken away under guard. And I'm just trying to think where we went after that. We didn't have a celebration. I mean, you couldn't celebrate there. I mean, there was so much destruction in that. You know, there was, you couldn't walk into a bar and say, I'll have a pint now, that it's all over, you know. We were celebrating with cups of tea and that. I think one of the officers had managed to smuggle a bottle of whiskey from somewhere, and we all had a little nip, you know, and that was it. And then I think our next big thing was a place called Recklinghausen in Germany. This was when the war was finished then. It was a place called Recklinghausen. We were given the job of drawing rations from the Germans to feed displaced persons, because there was different camps. There was Italians, Polish, Russians, every nationality there. They had been more or less slave workers for the Germans, you know. And I think, in a way, these people did help us a lot, because the possibility that shell which had come outside my dugout in the woods near Smacht, I think it had been sabotaged, because a lot of the shells never went off at times. I think the workers had done a bit of sabotage on whatever was what, you know. And we had the job of feeding these persons. Being one of the old sweats, I got the job of with the quartermaster. I was help. Well, actually, I was doing bodyguard to the quartermaster. I think he's I forgot his name now.
Captain.
I forgot his name now. And I used to do bodyguard to him when we went to this big German factory. I used to sit in a jeep with him and the clerk, who used to do all the booking and that. And we used to go and draw the rations for these different camps, because each company of the brigade had a each company of the battalion had a camp to look after, responsible for making sure these people got the food. And being an ex-butcher, I was able to help with distribution of the meat, which wasn't a lot, but we rationed it out as best we could. We took over a school. It was a big school in Recklinghausen. Was held by the Yanks at the time, and we took over from them. But first, before we went there, I went with the captain and that to negotiate with the Yanks to take the building over. And when we got there, at the gates, there was a couple of Yanks in the crouch position, chewing sweets and having a good old chat. Supposed to be on guard duty, you know. And we went up to them and said, you know, could we speak to the officer in charge? Oh, yes, I think you said you want Joe or somebody. I think Joe was a captain or a colonel or something, you know. So when we got into the playground, it was a playground of the school, we could hear this someone shooting, you know. We thought, hello, I hope it doesn't start again. And it was these Yanks around the back of the building throwing the steel helmets up and taking pot shots with these 45 revolvers. Anyway, when we finally took the building over, they asked us if we'd like some boiled sweets. And there must have been about 600 weight of boiled sweets in the in their stores. So, you know, we're quite grateful for that, because we hadn't seen many sweets during the fighting and that. So this was our headquarters. We used to go from there every morning, we'd leave there about, Valley was about 5, that was 4 or 5, we used to leave there about 6 and go in convoy to this big German factory. And the captain would go up to the manager of the factory, and we used to draw this bread, horrible looking stuff. It was like a dark brown, looked like a dark brown paste which had been cooked on the outside, you know. And the captain would go up there, and one of the Germans would hand him a knife, and he would cut through the bread. Not as though he knew anything about bread, but it was like the advert on the telly, you know, with this fruit juice advert where the chap nods his head, you know, and everybody goes berserk. Well, once the captain nodded his head, the truck started being loaded up, you know, odds and ends of whatever was available. So we used to go back to the school, and then we used to distribute so much food for each camp. I was on guard duty one night there, and Corporal Richardson was a chap. He was Geordie. Married man with, I think he had 2 children, and he was the guard commander at the time. And we had a call through from one of the German people that I think it was one of the Poles had been stealing potatoes from the garden. And Corporal Richardson said, "It's all right," he said, "I'll go and sort it out," like, you know. So next thing we knew, he'd been shot. He'd been shot with a handmade revolver, shot through this window. Apparently he'd found the people who were stealing the potatoes, and he was shot dead. But we never found the person who had done it. You know, we rushed there, and we had them all out there, the camp, but nobody owned up to it. And this was after the war was finished.
What rank did he have?
He was a corporal. Corporal Richardson. And we'd done all this looking after the displaced persons, and then we were sent down to Belgium, to Ghent in Belgium. We was billeted in Ghent, and we was billeted with the civilians I was in with a Louis de Klerk was his name. He was a major in the White Brigade, which was the Belgium underground. Lovely man he was, and his wife was nice. They had two children then, and we was billeted there for some time. And then one day we got the orders that we were going to move. So they said, if you've got any surplus kit, get rid of it. Because we thought we was going home, we was going to fly home for a leave, you know. And we was quite pleased, quite excited about all this. So we got rid of any surplus what we had. And the next thing, we're on these 3-ton trucks. We finish up at the railway station. And we thought, oh, we must be going by train. And these trains, they were, I think they were about 100 years old, these trains. They were just small wooden compartments. And of course, there's about 6 of us in a compartment. You've got kit bags and rifles and whatever, you know. And 2 days later, on the train, we arrived in Toulon. So we got to Toulon, and the next thing, we were on a boat. We thought, it's a funny way to go home. And we finished up going through the Med, and we landed in Port Said. It was on one of these Liberty ships, and of course, everybody runs to the, I don't know what the Navy call it, the side where you can see the quayside and that. And of course, the boat sort of went over. Must have been short of ballast in the base of the boat. And anyway, we slept on the boat that night. The next day we came off there. I mean, we still had this winter gear on. And I mean, it was very hot then when we arrived. I forget when it was, what month it was.
Is this the whole battalion?
This was a whole division. But I'm just speaking as like with the battalion. But it was actually the whole division who moved over there. And the next thing, we're on trucks, and we finish up in, I don't know, it was a desert. It was just a desert. You know, there was nothing there. There was only canvas. And they still got us doing guard duty, marching up and down, and there's not a soul about. All it is sand and canvas. And we still got this this winter stuff on, you know. And we were sweating away. Anyway, later on, we was issued with KD, khaki drill, short trousers and that sort of thing, you know. They gave us a Canadian butter dress, which was beautifully well made, lovely greenish colour, you know. We had white socks, and we done some guard duties there, like marching up and down, nothing to guard, just tents, but we done guard duties not there. And and then the next place they moved us to was a place called, I think it was, I forget, El Kassassin, I think the name of the place was. El Kassassin, that was it. And they had these bombers there, which they had converted into troop carriers, you know. And I don't know what the idea was, but we suddenly found out that it was when the terrorists and that was going, when all this terrorism and the Jews were trying to land, you know, in Palestine. And this was what it was. You know, the idea was that fly us to any part where there was problems, and we could act straight away, like, you know. But after a while in Egypt, we got onto these trucks, and we went through the Sinai Desert, and we finished up just outside of Jerusalem. And we were doing guards on the King David Hotel there, which had already been blown up. And High Commissioner's Guard. And the camp we were in was canvas, and we had these walls built round the tents, and we thought, well, that's funny, what do they want walls round tents for? And then we suddenly realised that night time the terrorists used to come and lob a few mortar bombs over in the dark, and then they'd have it away again, you know. And this went on for quite some time, and then we started doing searches in the villages for any arms, you know, and this sort of thing. Any problems in Jerusalem we had to go into. And we'd done a lot of work with the Palestine police, and sometimes if we got mortar bombed, the police used to come with their, what do you call them, bloodhounds, you know, they could smell the scent and that. And their dogs, but we never used to find anyone. The dogs used to lose track after a while, because I think they used to use these mortars and then jump back into a taxi and then they'd be away again, you know. And that was more or less part of our duty, you know. It was just sort of doing High Commissioner's Guard and searching villages, doing 5 o'clock raids on the village to see if we could find small arms and that, you know.
What did you find in the villages?
Mostly people and cockroaches. You go into a house and you'd pull these clothes by, and all of a sudden these cockroaches would all, you know, they just used to, I suppose, the people got used with having cockroaches in the house, you know, part of the family. And then after a while, next thing, I got a job. I was being one of the old soldiers and time for retirement, you know. I was given the job of company clerk with A Company. And that's when I was promoted to Lance Corporal. It was more or less a protection stripe, you know. And we was all allowed to have a dog each. And I had a lovely little mongrel thing. And he was lovely company, this dog. But there wasn't much more after that. There was just the searches and this sort of thing.
What was your attitude towards the Zionists who were launching the attack?
Well, I think it was terrible that time when they hung the Paras, because Paras, the 6th Airborne, came over. We'd worked with them in Normandy and that, you know, and 6th Airborne had come over. And they was doing guards, Tel Aviv and them places. And a lot of them was shot, and, you know, these chaps in the a lot of them was shot by the terrorists, and there was some of our chaps hung in the orchard as well. Terrible.
Did you ever make friends from amongst the civilian population in Palestine?
Well, we didn't really get much. We didn't have much contact with them. You know, it was like the Germans when we first defeated them in Recklinghausen. We weren't allowed to speak to or fraternise with anyone. And there again, half us couldn't speak whatever the language, Arabic or whatever it was, you know. Couldn't speak that, couldn't understand them anyway.
Did you feel frightened in Palestine?
Yes, when the mortars were coming over. There was one time then when we had this, was really torrential rain. And the camp we was at was thick mud, you know. And you used to go into your tent, and you'd have about a stone of this clay stuff around your boots, you know. So you used to leave your boots behind on the floor, get on your bed and undress down on the bed. It was so bad there at times. And we were like the Navy, we was sort of splicing the main brace. We were given this rum ration of a night time, you know, because it did used to get very cold of a night and damp.
This is in Jerusalem?
This was in Jerusalem, yeah.
Was that the only place you lived in Palestine?
Yes. Well, we didn't actually live in Jerusalem. It was just on the outskirts, you know. was a sort of a camp on the outskirts of Jerusalem. I remember one time they're being attacked by these, what do they call them again, these big insects?